I think people get the fact that this is the future and are gobsmacked and to some extent appalled that the Prime Minister that they remember saying, Malcolm Turnbull that is, saying that he wouldn't lead a party not as committed to effective action on climate change as he was, has developed and announced an energy plan that has not a single renewable energy project built for a decade, halves the rate of rooftop solar installation, and is now looking at channeling billions of dollars into coal-fired plants, which the industry itself says are uninvestable.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I am also the host of this show. This week, we're sticking with energy policy, my favourite. The government's National Energy Guarantee, for folks watching on at home, you'll all know that that policy is still alive, but perhaps only just. So I've invited the man who will singularly, he says, she says, looking at him and he's just blanched, determine whether or not it continues to live or whether or not the policy dies. The person I'm speaking to this week in the studio is Mark Butler, the Shadow Minister for Climate Change. Mark, thank you for stepping into the pod cave.
It's great to be here. A little claustrophobic, but he's otherwise great.
He's managing quite well. He's breathing through. Now, let's just start with an in-principle question. How important is it, because everybody says it is, I want to know if you think it is, how important is it to have a bipartisan agreement on a policy mechanism in climate and energy? Is it important?
Well, stepping back from the National Energy Guarantee debate for a second, for any democracy to undertake the changes necessary to meet the international goals we've set ourselves or commitments we've made to keep global warming well below 2 degrees Celsius, it is essential to have some level of bipartisan agreement to a trajectory or a policy framework. We've seen that all around the world. The UK is doing extraordinary things. The decarbonisation there is just gobsmacking. By 2030, they'll have achieved carbon cuts of 61% across their economy. At the moment, our trajectory looks like there won't be really any cuts at all off a 2005 baseline. Mm-hmm. And the only reason they've achieved that is because they've taken the politics out of climate change and energy.
Extraordinary.
They've had bipartisanship there really since 2008 when David Cameron, who was then the leader of the Conservative opposition, decided to depoliticise this particular area of policy. Now, obviously, your listeners know it's not as if UK politics is all sweetness and light. I mean, they fight hard over there. They've just chosen not to fight over climate change and energy policy. And that bipartisanship has been able to survive some incredibly torrid, toxic periods, including, for example, the Brexit aftermath. Still, we have these bipartisan, ambitious 5-year carbon budgets agreed that see the UK more than doing its fair share of the global task. Around the world, you can also see other democracies that are doing things successfully are only doing that on a bipartisan foundation of policy frameworks. And where it's not working, like Australia, it's largely not working, not because there's not the technology, not because there's not the community will, not because there's not businesses willing to take opportunities in a low carbon economy. It's because this building cannot get its act together.
Something deeply wrong with this building. Okay, just going on from that point, is it worth compromising in order to reach a bipartisan agreement on a mechanism?
Well, I think given particularly the toxic history of politics in this area in Australia over 10 years, even the most optimistic observers or actors in this debate recognise that you're not going to change things overnight. And you need to find a way to build confidence and build frameworks that slowly bring us to a culture of bipartisanship. And that inevitably will mean there are still substantial differences, perhaps, between the major parties over levels of ambition, over the degree to which you focus on restrictions for broad-scale land clearing, for example, in states like Queensland and New South Wales. But what we need to do is find examples where the major parties in particular can maturely reach agreement. And build on that. And the energy debate really is the opportunity now to do that.
So, well, that brings us very neatly to the National Energy Guarantee. What's going to happen when the government brings this legislation to the parliament? Because we know from the coalition party room agreement, in inverted commas, so-called, this week, that this policy will not lift out of the House of Representatives on current indications if Labor doesn't back it, because there are a number of people on the coalition side of the chamber who are signalling they are prepared to cross the floor, and let's assume that at least some of them are serious. And we know how finely balanced the numbers are in the House. So without Labor being on board, at least for stage one of this debate in the House of Representatives, it's going nowhere. What will you do?
Well, we haven't seen legislation yet, and I think everyone understands that now for at least a couple of years, there's been a substantial difference between the two major parties over levels of ambition. And that the question of ambition is really the only thing that the Commonwealth legislation is going to deal with. There's obviously the separate question of the National Energy Guarantee, yeah, the investment framework that the states and territories and the Commonwealth are dealing with through a COAG process. I see that, or describe that, as the building of a car, if you like. What the Commonwealth does is determine where the car is driven. Is it driven into the future with ambitious decarbonisation, or as I said earlier, is it driven back to the 1950s with no renewable energy built and taxpayer funding going into coal-fired power plants? I mean, that's really the matter of dispute, the journey, the vision, the level of ambition around decarbonisation of our energy sector that the Commonwealth Parliament will be dealing with, separate from the question of the actual mechanism. So here we have a very clear difference between the Labor Party and the Liberal Party coalition, and that will be fought out in the Commonwealth Parliament. Now, ultimately, you know, amendments will be moved and debates will be had. I'm sure there'll be a pretty serious inquiry process in the Senate, because this is very important legislation that will have a substantial impact on our economy and our society in many ways. But we, you know, obviously we've not decided, and we're not foreshadowing quite what tactical decisions we'll be taking at every step of the way. And I don't think a range of the crossbenchers or those within the government that are considering maybe crossing the floor have made a final decision either.
Mm. But we did see, for example, fairly recently, the Labor Party had a substantial disagreement with the government on, let's call it, the level of ambition in personal income tax cuts. We did see the Labor Party in the House allow that legislation to clear the House and go to the Senate, where that debate was fought more viscerally, I suppose, in the upper house, where there's many more actors and many more players. Mm. So is that a model worth considering?
Well, it's one model, and it's the most recent model, I guess, of highly contentious legislation around the weighting of income tax for low-income earners against high-income earners. There are other models where we've, you know, fought tooth and nail for particular positions within the House. We just haven't made that decision yet. Mm-hmm. Obviously, those are discussions we're going to have when we see the legislation and we start to understand a little more clearly what the government's proposing by way of a timetable for debate.
And now we assume that the Labor Party, once this debate starts, will try and increase the ambition in the target from 26%, which is the government's preference, or a real target of 2% over the decade based on the ESB modelling, but set that to one side. Government 26%, Labor's been telegraphing 45%, but that's actually your economy-wide emissions reduction target. Now, there would be a school of thought that says if you want 45% out of the economy, then your pro rata in electricity is a lot higher than 40%, could be 60%. So what are we going to see when this debate happens? Are we going to see 45, which is what you've been telegraphing, or something higher than
that? Yeah, we'll be moving 45%. I mean, I think there is a debate within business, within think tanks and academic circles and other institutions that think about this clearly, about whether or not the electricity sector should do more than its mathematical share. So, for example, pretty much all of the energy industry has said it should. The National Farmers Federation has said it should. Other big energy users like Woodside has said it should. But at the moment, I think, particularly from a position of opposition, where we're only dealing with an energy piece of legislation and we don't have advice before us about what transport can do between now and 2030, what the land sector can do, what manufacturing and mining can do, for example, we're really in a position where we're going to move an amendment that is 45%. Mm-hmm. That's really been the position modelled through the process, the 26% versus 45%. And I think that is the position about which all of the actors in this debate have the best advice.
Mm-hmm. And the Labor states, for example, have been saying that it's important for the government to concede on target setting, like set aside the quantum for the minute, whether it's 26 or 45, but how you set the target, whether it's done in legislation or whether it's done in regulation. In the event that the government came to you, and this is entirely hypothetical because neither of us know whether this is going to happen, but in the event the government came to you with a scenario that said, OK, we'll concede the point about target setting in legislation, will allow that to be done in a subordinate instrument in regulation, would that make Labor any more likely to put a 26% target through the parliament at this point, given the proximity of an election where Labor can go to the people and argue the case for increased ambition?
Look, I mean, there are so many potential hypotheticals here. I mean, the permutations are potentially endless that I really don't want to get into a response to every hypothetical. I guess as a matter of principle, we've taken a view now for a long time that we need to make the case for 45%. And we'll be making that through the parliament, through both houses. And we'll continue to make it in the community. We think it's the way to discharge our obligation through international agreements, but perhaps more importantly, to future generations. And we think it's also the way to create real jobs and investment in an exciting industry that will put downward pressure on wholesale power prices through such a substantial expansion of renewable energy. So we're going to make that case. We've also said, as a matter of principle, though, that it's really important that this legislation not tie the hands of future governments in being able to lift the targets. Because even though, for example, business groups have said very strongly they want the NEG put in place, they want the National Energy Guarantee put in place, they've also said, and the Prime Minister and Minister Frydenberg don't refer to this much, they've also said very broadly, these targets inevitably will have to be lifted. They'll inevitably have to be lifted, either because the energy sector itself sees itself needing to renew its infrastructure, or other sectors of the economy which are going to be impacted by a 2% target being so low, So as a matter of principle, we're very strongly of the view, and we'll be pursuing the debate to say, look, we're not going to cop any devices to lock in low ambition. And I'm really pleased that the state governments are also taking an opportunity to have a debate or a negotiation with the Commonwealth about this issue as well, because they obviously have a strong view, or particularly the Labor states have a strong view about agreeing to a mechanism that has such low ambition.
Mm. And the government is clearly setting up an election. Well, we've seen the coalition in the carbon price fight in 2013 turn an issue about climate change into an issue of cost of living and defeat a Labor government. We've seen that happen before. Clearly, the government thinks it can do this again by turning the debate that we're having now around ambition in the NEG target into a cost of living fight at the next election that Labor loses. Does history repeat itself here? And if not, why not?
Well, I don't think it does. Obviously, I hope it doesn't, but I genuinely don't think it does.
What's different?
Well, the actors are a little different, but I'll put that aside. The main difference, I think, is the passage of time over the last several years has demonstrated, I think, beyond anyone's hope several years ago, just how deployable, just how competitive renewable energy is. And I think the community gets that. I think sometimes in the bubble of Parliament House, we lose sight of the fact that the vast bulk of the community out there want to see a country with the best solar radiation resources in the world, such great wind resources, really good brains that have been at the forefront of developing this technology in recent decades. They want to see their country be a renewable energy superpower. And I think a real mistake that Tony Abbott made in 2013, 2014 was to think that he could translate or transplant a debate about a carbon tax or a carbon price mechanism, you know, an economy-wide pricing mechanism, to a wholesale attack on an industry that has very strong support in the community. Mm. And I think people get the fact that this is the future and are gobsmacked and to some extent appalled that the Prime Minister that they remember saying, Malcolm Turnbull that is, saying that he wouldn't lead a party not as committed to effective action on climate change as he was, has developed and announced an energy plan that has not a single renewable energy project built for a decade, halves the rate of rooftop solar installation, and is now looking at channeling billions of dollars into coal-fired plants, which the industry itself says are uninvestable. So I'm very confident that we're on the side of the community here. The vast bulk of the community want an expansion of renewable energy because it is the future. But I think people also recognise that and understand what people have been saying now for several years. This is the cheapest form of new energy. this is the cheapest form of new energy, not just the cleanest, not just one that has really exciting opportunities for jobs and investment and innovation. It's also the cheapest, and it's going according to modelling that Reputex has put out, put downward pressure on wholesale power prices in a way that the sort of low or zero ambition of Malcolm Turnbull's won't do.
Just a couple of things about process. Will you consider this legislation before the states have signed off on the National Energy Guarantee? Because that is going to take weeks, and on current indications, Victoria may not sign on before it goes into caretaker for its state election. Will you consider this legislation in the event that the states have not signed off?
I'm open on that point. You know, if for example the states and the Commonwealth through the COAG process come to a view that they want the legislation in the Commonwealth Parliament either to proceed by way of debate and inquiry on a two-track basis, I'm open to that. No one's formally put that to me yet. Certainly the Commonwealth hasn't. You know, I guess our position is very clear. We're going to argue it through the Parliament, whether that's over the next couple of months or whether it's sort of October, November or some other timetable.
And you've said repeatedly over the last several weeks, it's very clear, in fact, that more Commonwealth support for coal-fired power, either through this ACCC underwriting recommendation or through some other mechanism, is a deal-breaker for Labor. You've been very clear about that for weeks and weeks. But I want to draw you out on that a little bit, because I want to know how you can control that, in the sense that the government is clearly not going to bolt on a big investment in coal-fired power onto this NEG legislation. It's clearly not going to be done that way. It's going to be done via a response to the ACCC's report later in the year, or perhaps even next year. It's hard to say, right? So I understand the line you're drawing in the sand, but how do you actually defend the line you're drawing in the sand? Because you're considering two separate issues. So how do you insist on your precondition?
Well, it's a bit hard for me to answer that, because I'm really only responding at the moment to a thought bubble from the Prime Minister. I don't know how he intends to operationalise his newfound commitment to building new coal-fired power stations in the country. What I do know is that it's a very serious misrepresentation of the ACCC recommendation. The ACCC chair, Rod Sims, made it clear very shortly after releasing the report that it was not, to use his words, targeted at coal. And indeed, the businesses that had been raising this sort of gap in the market, if you like, to use their description, no one had raised the idea of building new coal-fired power stations as a solution to filling that gap. They were all talking about renewable energy, pumped hydro, other firming products, and maybe some gas.
Yes.
So I guess we don't really know what Malcolm Turnbull and Josh Frydenberg have in mind by way of a serious policy funded and all the rest. All we do know that is that if it's about taxpayers funding and taking enormous future risk around new coal-fired power stations, we're going to oppose it.
What if, for example, you know, if that nice Trevor St Baker from Delta or whatever his company is, the chap who's around saying, oh, yes, I'd build a coal plant or retrofit or something. Let's say he emerged and the Commonwealth agreed to either underwriting the finance or some sort of indemnity against future carbon risk. What does the Labor Party do then?
Well, we're opposed to it. Is our statement of principle, but obviously quite what shape that takes, what process the Prime Minister tries to take to enter into a contract with someone, whether it's Delta Electricity or someone else, is a little unclear, and so I can't really respond to it to
well,
a
it's
thought
sort of,
bubble.
Well,
but I'll just
sure.
make the point, just make the point again. The industry has said this is completely uninvestable. Now, Mr. St. Baker has come out relatively recently. Before that, for the whole 18 months that Malcolm Turnbull has been plaintively seeking business partners for new coal-fired power stations, the only business figure to stick his hand up was Clive Palmer, the only one. All of the rest of them recognise, and the lenders and the investors recognise, they read the International Energy Agency reports. They know what is going to happen to unabated coal-fired power through the 2030s, early 2040s at the latest. Mm-hmm. And they know building a new coal-fired power station, which takes 8 to 12 years, according to the industry, costs a bomb, which Scott Morrison himself conceded, delivers much more expensive power than renewable energy, even with a firmed up product attached to it, would involve huge risk to taxpayers, running to billions of dollars.
No, all that's true. And you're quite correct to say it's a thought bubble. But I'm asking you, I suppose, let me ask you the question in a different way. I'm asking you whether you're prepared to run the sovereign risk gauntlet in the event that the government thinks it's politic before an election to, say, make a declarative statement about a particular development, underwriting, whatever is sought. What is Labor prepared? Because obviously if Labor comes out and says, well, we're not going to back that, what immediately follows is a debate about sovereign risk. Are you prepared to cop a debate about sovereign risk? It's really me testing how hard this coal line is for you. How hard? Where is the coal line, and how vigorously do you defend it?
Well, again, I think you're trying to draw me into hypotheticals, but let me say this. I mean, sovereign risk has a particular meaning. Technically, and I think is a little overused sometimes in political debate, not suggesting you are, of course, Catherine, but
you
obviously
could, of course, Mark, if you wanted to,
far too polite for that. But I mean, we have a strong view about maintaining investor confidence in an economy like Australia that depends so much on investment, including overseas investment. But equally, we have been crystal clear about our view on this. We have been crystal clear about the idea of, well, first of all, new coal-fired power stations just not being good for the energy system or for our economy, but the idea that taxpayers would take on a risk that investors are not willing to take on, I think would be a gross abuse of the political office of Prime Minister.
So you would say no?
Well, we've said no. Like, I've said no, really. I mean, no one was talking about building new coal-fired power stations until Malcolm Turnbull did this bizarre press club speech in January last year. Now, everyone expected he was going to come out and announce an ambitious plan for decarbonising our transport system. That had been the speculation dropped by the government to newspapers before that landmark speech in January last year. And instead, he comes out with this bizarre idea of building new coal-fired power stations. So this has only really been a debate in the last 18 months because before that, no one was thinking about it. Tony Abbott didn't even talk about building new coal-fired power stations. Such was the investor sort of position about this. So over that, since Malcolm Turnbull launched this debate, Labor has been crystal clear. We have been crystal clear about our view on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what's Labor's plans for the rest of the economy? Because one of the weirdest things about the NEG debate, and there are many weird things about the NEG debate, but one of the weirdest things is that we have engaged ourselves in a discussion now spanning more than 18 months about one sector of the Australian economy in which emissions are currently falling. So there's been no conversation about what happens to transport, no conversation about what happens in areas of the economy where emissions are rising. So what is Labor's proposal on the sections of the economy where emissions are currently rising?
Well, there may not have been conversations through the media or in this building, but I've been having conversations and roundtables with all of those sectors of the economy precisely for that purpose. I did that before the last election, and over the last few months I've been having a series of roundtables, usually with my shadow ministerial colleagues. So, for example, in the transport sector with Anthony Albanese, in finance with Chris Bowen, in industry with Kim Carr, and in resources with Jason Clare. And we intend to do what we did before the last election, which was to put out a very detailed policy. I think our last policy went to 43 pages, and it will have a plan for every sector of the economy. In broad terms, I guess, in transport, I think we've been very clear for a number of years now that Australia needs to adopt mandatory emission standards for its vehicles. We're now the only OECD country that doesn't have them. 80% of the global car fleet operates according to under mandatory emission standards, which see a downward trajectory of particularly carbon from cars. And it is just beyond reason that we don't have that, particularly as a technology taker, as we are now in the car industry. But I think since the last election, there's been this extraordinary, very exciting revolution around electric vehicles. We've engaged really interestingly with the industry about that as well, to make sure that we have a plan to ensure that Australia is ready for the electric vehicle revolution that will really find its way through the industry over the course, I think, of the 2020s.
Mm-hmm.
We have a plan in the land sector around land clearing that we were very clear about before the last election. We have a plan in, I guess, the rest of the economy where there are large, what we used to call liable entities, so large polluters polluting more than 25,000 tonnes a year, bringing that threshold down and having some sort of emissions trading scheme. And we're engaged with those industries about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be, yes, Mark has to run. It's watch this space.
Thanks, Catherine.
Yes, no worries. Anyway, so that was Mark Butler running, literally, here you are on a live recording, running for a division in the House of Representatives. I think we got a fairly substantial watch this space in relation to that last answer, which is intriguing. Thank you so very much for listening. We really do appreciate it. Thank you to Miles Martignoni and to Hannah Izard for production, as always. Now, if you like the listening, please don't forget to subscribe via your favourite podcast app or wherever you get your pods from. It's really important that you do that. Parliament continues, obviously. We're back from the winter recess this week and we're into another sitting week next week, and I will be back with you then.